Hello, this is Elodie Reed, digital producer for Vermont Public Radio. This podcast has been edited for brevity and clarity. Yay!
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. When the threat of the novel coronavirus reached Vermont, colleges and universities here were forced to close down their campuses and send most students home. There's no question that when, or for some, if people return to campus this fall, it will be with unprecedented changes. Everyone engaged in on-campus learning is grappling right now with what to do. Administrators, faculty and staff, students and their families, and community members in areas where students congregate. Today on Vermont Edition, we're going to get a sense of what the conversations and considerations are like at a handful of colleges and universities around the state. Let's start today with the University of Vermont, the largest of Vermont's colleges and universities, with more than 13,000 students across all of its programs. UVM recently announced pay cuts for more than 2,000 non-union employees. Brad Bowerly teaches political science at UVM and is part of a group called UVM United Against Cuts.
These cuts were sudden and shocking. They were confusing and they were damaging to the UVM community. These cuts have done a lot of damage to morale across the university. And this comes at a time when we will most likely be called upon to work in difficult and shifting circumstances again in the fall.
Now, the university says it has to make cuts, eliminate some programs like its child care center, and may even need to furlough workers in order to make it through the financial downturn spurred on by the COVID-19 crisis and because of budget challenges that predated the pandemic. UVM is planning on welcoming students back to campus, though not all of them. About 13,000 students are expected to return to classes. About 6,000 will live on campus. On-campus students will mix in-person, online, called asynchronous, and remote, called synchronous, instruction, and have some access to on-campus facilities. Students have until later this week to decide whether to do that or to stay home and attend everything remotely. There's no change in tuition or comprehensive fees for the coming school year. UVM has decided to increase testing requirements for students over and above what the state of Vermont requires. All students will be required to participate in twice-weekly sampling and testing for COVID-19 on campus for free. And when students leave for Thanksgiving break, they won't return to campus until the new year, finishing courses and taking their exams remotely. In a few minutes, we'll hear from a UVM undergraduate and a faculty member. But first, UVM Provost Patty Prelock is with us. Welcome to the program. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Jane, for having me.
Let me ask you about the testing requirements that I just mentioned for UVM, because these do go above and beyond the state guidelines. The state guidelines want students to be tested when they first arrive on campus. Why is UVM planning to do twice-weekly sampling and testing?
Well, we're trying to follow the best possible evidence and advice from our public health officials and the CDC guidelines. So we're working towards having very strict regulations. We will see if we're able to do the twice weekly, as you mentioned, but our goal is to exceed the expectations so that we can make sure that we create a healthy environment for our students, faculty, and staff.
So will faculty and staff also be required to participate in testing?
We haven't made that decision yet. We will be talking with them about the expectations, probably going to their primary care physicians if they feel that they've come in contact with someone with COVID. But we don't have that as an expectation at this point in time.
What would happen if a student does test positive?
Yeah, so there is a process through our student health services, and we collaborate with the Vermont Department of Health, and we go through a contract tracing framework where we identify who the individual was with. The student also then is quarantined, and there's a whole process that we put in our document, which has been guided by actually the wonderful leadership of our governor and our Vermont Department of Health. So there's a whole process that the students are, if they do test positive, there's an isolation space. If they get sick, there's quarantine when they first arrive. So there's a whole process that we follow, again, following the evidence that we have.
I think some students and perhaps faculty and staff as well are concerned about, you know, what are the chances that we get to campus in the fall and then we have to leave 6 weeks later because of an outbreak? How do you sort of deal with those unknowns?
Yeah, sure. I know that's always a question. Do we have a contingency plan? Yes, our initial work has really been our fall planning, safe return to school and to work. We all have resumption plans for all of our activities and coming back to the office. And I think we've been following the governor's guidance, and he's done a very good job. So we're trying to follow that as well. And we have it for our research. And then if there is an outbreak, we're working on some metrics that follow science to determine at what point do we have to stop all in-person instruction and what do we do from that point forward. So we'll have step-down plans, and we've already developed our step-down plans for research, and we'll be working on those from an educational perspective. But as you know, we did it in the spring. We figured it out, and we didn't have as much time. Now we've learned a lot. We have a lot more experience. Our faculty have been outstanding in their efforts to learn new strategies. And because we have our educational system designed to always do live streaming and remote if we need to, I'm confident that we'll be able to figure out a plan, and most importantly, to keep people safe.
But if I'm a student trying to decide by July 17th whether I'm going to return to campus or not, you know, there's so much information, and so much of it is, as how you said it, you know, there are these plans and step, you know, it kind of gets complicated. You know, is there an easy cheat sheet?
Yes, great question. So we always encourage our students, our families, our faculty and staff to visit our return to campus plan. That's a website that kind of organizes everything. We also are having pretty regular live video events with returning students and their families, as well as new students and their families. And I have weekly open live events with my faculty. And then we also have periodic events with staff, just so they can ask their questions. And then we have several FAQs. But these are big decisions for students, and we want them here. The reason we offered the remote option is we know that some families and their students may not feel comfortable coming to campus, but we still wanted them to be able to remain a Catamount. And so this is why we have the remote option. But remember, remote doesn't mean online only asynchronous. It does mean you could be live streaming with your faculty members. So there's students in class, but there are students at home on their computer. And we have all our other activities, advising, et cetera, virtually. And we've gotten pretty sophisticated at having Teams meetings with students so that they feel they're connected.
Speaking of remaining a Catamount, one of the things that students will have to do is to sign the Green and Gold Promise, this pledge to follow state guidance and school requirements on risk prevention for COVID-19. And violations are subject to a fine and an educational sanction. Repeated violations are subject to being removed from campus and unenrolled, essentially. We're going to hear from a student in a moment, and many students and many community members are concerned that students won't be following the pledge. And perhaps it's, you know, difficult in some cases for students to know exactly where the line is. How are you going to enforce the Green and Gold Promise, and how are you going to enforce it for students who are living off campus?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. I think I'm really counting on our students following our common ground, which we've instilled in them from the beginning when they started being a Catamount, and that is respect for others, having integrity in the things that they do, being open to things that are going to look different, being innovative in our approach to answer questions, and being responsible and make sure that we're being just in our efforts. So, you know, there's two ways to look at it. We certainly have a code of conduct, and we've given students a lot of expectations in terms of signing the pledge and taking the VOSHA training so that they really understand it. But I also, from my discipline background, want to have a positive campaign for students. So in fact, our Larner College of Medicine students and our Doctor of Nursing Practice students said they want to be sort of peer ambassadors or create videos to help other students realize this is your role in keeping our community safe. And maybe one of the reasons that you really want to do this is not just to keep people safe, but because you want to stay on campus. And the only way you can stay on campus is if you follow the rules. So we're going to try and use a positive piece too, but we will be very clear if students do not follow the rules.
Before we let you go, the UVM Communications Department told us that the school won't let you be on with our next two guests, a student and a faculty member, or to have you come on after them. So we're not going to be able to get an administrative response to their questions and concerns. If not on air, how are you responding to concerns being raised by faculty, staff, and students?
So there's a great deal of anxiety with so much uncertainty. I think you feel it, Jane. I feel it. My family does. But I think that we're always guided by a philosophy that we gather information and insight. We have a balanced and pragmatic assessment of the issues, and then we chart a course to follow as a community. And we do it in a responsible and informed way by science and advice from our public health experts. So our faculty are fully represented. They're active participants. They work on our UVM Strong Advisory Committee. In fact, our president and vice president of Faculty Senate are part of our working groups, along with six other Faculty Senate representatives. As I mentioned before, we have frequent team live video opportunities with faculty for them to ask questions. And I just spent my weekend answering another 60 questions that we will put on FAQs. So I am confident, and I do understand that our faculty and students and the administration, we all want the same thing. We want a healthy and safe community, and we want a place where we can learn and have a job. And so I think if we just keep that philosophy, we will serve the university well.
That's Patty Prelock, Provost for the University of Vermont. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Jane.
While we're talking about what's happening at UVM and the various concerns and enthusiasm that many people feel about the fall, lots of students hoping and wanting to return both to classes and to see their friends and faculty, favorite professors. Let's get the perspective of a faculty member and a student. On the line with us now is Isaac Lee, a rising junior from Burlington. Hi, Isaac. Welcome.
Hello.
And Nancy Welch, an English professor, a member of the United Academics Faculty Union, and author of the recent essay, A Semester to Die For. Hello, Professor Welch. Nice to talk with you as well.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Isaac, can you start with, you know, what you're thinking? And there may be a swirl of feelings, so I'm not anticipating that, you know, it's all criticism or all negative or all positive, but how are you approaching the fall semester?
So I'll say this. UVM has done a lot. You know, they're testing. They're going to be testing people twice a week. They have a very clear set of strict rules. But what I've seen is that there's a lack of clarity in how those rules will be enforced. You know, there's already been reports of, you know, up to 40 people partying. And, you know, when people arrive in the thousands from all different states, I can't help but feel that even more partying and even more rule breaking is inevitable. I don't believe that people are going to stick to the green and gold promise. And I feel that UVM saying that we must stay strong together as a community, communicate the message of we are on our own and that help is not coming.
So what do you think UVM should do? Are you saying that you think it should be all remote learning?
Well, no, I don't believe that because with the recent ICE mandates, that wouldn't do well for our international students. Now, what I think people need to realize is that this is a problem not just on university level, but also a state and city level. On a state level, we have Governor Scott saying he's going to wait for numbers to change in order to shift directions. In other words, he's saying that he'd rather react to an outbreak rather than preventing one from happening in the first place. On the local level, both Burlington and South Burlington have mask-wearing mandates, but the mandates have not been enforced. For example, at stores, they have to put up signs that masks are required to enter, but even so, 10% of the customers still aren't wearing masks. And with a clear lack of enforcement at UVM, the burden of keeping each other safe has been left to the people. It feels like we're on our own. So what we need to see happen is a cooperation on every level of government so that we are not left to fend for ourselves.
What about you, Professor Welch? Where do you intersect with what Isaac is saying and what we heard from Provost a few minutes ago? You know, where do you come in on this?
Right. Well, first, since Provost Prelock made passing reference to science, I just want to point out a couple of scientific facts. When the university shut down last spring, the U.S. was averaging 500 new cases a day. Now, because of the rush in recent weeks to reopen, we are seeing more than 60,000 new cases a day.
Although not in Vermont by any means.
No. But Vermont does not live in a bubble, mm-hmm. by any means. And there are other cities and states, such as Pittsburgh, most recently, that thought that they had beaten this, and it's come roaring back. And already, several state universities have seen massive outbreaks. And at Penn State, a 21-year-old student has died, a student of color. It's important to note, because the virus is especially deadly for people of color, young and old. And the increasing scientific evidence is that when people gather for extended periods of time in enclosed spaces like classrooms and dorm rooms, cloth masks, social distancing, it's not enough protection. So my concern as an educator is that university reopening plans promise to increase infection rates, result in another shutdown, and so they're a threat to both public health and to educational and research continuity. And so with reference to the CDC, I think we should look at their document, Considerations for Institutions of Higher Education, that recommends virtual learning as really the only safe option in a surging pandemic. And that would mean making on-campus presence the exception, not the rule. And then to follow up on what Isaac said about international students, we need to join other universities in standing up against the bullying of the Trump White House. It's trying to blackmail universities and schools into reopening in incredibly dangerous conditions.
So, Professor Welch, are you planning to teach all of your courses remotely one way or another, whether it's, you know, either live streamed or done sort of on demand?
My teaching will be done remotely. My concern is that because the administration has not made this the rule, but instead the exception, that we are going to, we're not going to be able to provide very low density dorm housing for the students who do need a home for their learning. And we are not going to be able to safeguard the campus for those activities that are essential to happen on campus. And so, I think that also along these lines, to have a safe campus plus the majority of people, as the CDC has recommended for higher ed, engaged in student-centered remote teaching, we need our faculty, staff, and service maintenance workers in full force. No position cuts, no furloughs, no one compelled to work on campus, but for those who do need to be on campus, they need hazard pay and real PPE. A bottle of sanitizer and a cloth mask isn't going to cut it.
Isaac, what are you planning to do in the fall?
I'm currently planning to return to campus.
So you are going to return to, you live in Burlington though?
Yes, I'm currently in the Burlington area.
And so you're going to return to campus, live on campus in a dormitory?
I'm going to be living in the Redstone Loft in an apartment.
What do you think about what Professor Welch said, that there should be a priority placed on, students who need to be on campus for critical reasons? So I'm imagining research or nursing or some of the people who are doing things that cannot be done remotely, and have everybody else off campus for remote learning. Isaac, what do you think about that?
I'm not sure, I'll be honest.
And what excites you about returning to campus? I mean, you're obviously returning because you want to return, and this is such a big thing for so many faculty and staff, but especially students. So what are you excited for?
Let's see. If anything, all of my friends I've talked to, we do want to return to campus. We do want to see each other in person, ideally wearing masks 6 feet away. But also, I'm also worried about the people who have to come back to campus. It's not just people who have to work in a hospital. There's also a lot of people who are forced to come to campus because being at home is not a safe place for them to be right now.
Yeah, yeah. There's so many complicating factors. As I said, this is it's the briefest of overviews just to get a sense of what's going. So I know that both Isaac, you and Professor Welch have more to say and more thoughts on this, but we'll leave it there for today. Wishing you both the best of luck in the fall semester. Isaac Lee is a rising junior from Burlington. Thanks for talking with us, Isaac.
Thank you.
And Nancy Welch is an English professor, a member of the United Academics Faculty Union, and the author of a recent essay, A Semester to Die For. We'll link to it at vpr.org. Professor Welch, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're getting a sense from several different Vermont colleges and universities of how they're preparing for their fall semester, from accommodating some students and faculty who want classes to be online and some who want in-person instruction, to finding a way to protect the health of students, faculty and staff, and community members when students do return to town and campus. We just heard about UVM's challenges in getting the needs of about 13,000 students and thousands of faculty and staff members' needs met. Let's turn to Middlebury College now, where there are usually about 2,500 students, the majority from outside Vermont, returning to campus each year. Middlebury is among the more expensive schools in the nation and also has one of the country's larger college endowments. Middlebury is offering college faculty and students the option of on-campus learning or off-campus learning and teaching, or some combination of both, at least for professors. Staff members who work closely with students, like healthcare workers and residential life staff, will get PPE and training. So far, Middlebury plans to follow the state guidelines around testing, students for COVID-19 upon arrival to college, and then again 7 days later. Students who are on campus will be required to stay in-state throughout the semester and will not return after Thanksgiving break until after the new year. Joining us to talk more about what has them encouraged or discouraged, how they're thinking about the fall semester, are Jeff Kaysen, Provost and Executive Vice President of the college. Thank you very much for joining us today, Jeff.
Thank you, Jane.
Maya G., a rising junior at Middlebury College, who's from Waikoloa, Hawaii. Maya, nice to talk with you. Thanks for being with us in this early morning for you. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Jane.
And Lori Essig, professor and director of gender studies. She's also president of the roughly 190-member Middlebury AAUP. That's the college's chapter of the American Association of University Professors. Professor Essig, thank you very much for joining us, too.
Thanks for having me.
Maya, you're in Hawaii right now. What are you thinking of doing for the fall semester? Your should be your junior fall at Middlebury College.
I'm planning to return back to campus to pursue my fall semester.
Why? What made you decide to do that?
It was a combination of things. I think the main thing for me is academically, it really, really helps to be in the same time zone to take my classes, even if most of my classes are online. But I think this summer I really kind of grappled with the fact that this is kind of a new norm for higher education. This is kind of what we're going to be expecting in my final 2 years of my undergraduate education, kind of the online, in-person mix of things. And also realizing that the social life aspect of it will forever be changed as well. And that this isn't something that's going to be kind of a one-off semester or a one-off school year. This is something that's going to be ongoing and continuous. And I've kind of just realized that this is something that a lot of students are going to have to adapt to. And I think it's really great that the college is opening, because there are a lot of students, whether if they're from across the country, if they're from out of the country, if they have unstable home situations, that really rely on living on campus to, you know, pursue and finish their undergraduate education.
So, Jeff Kaysen, you know, Middlebury made the choice here of having on-campus learning and allowing professors and students to figure out, you know, are you going to be doing your learning and teaching online or in person or some combination of both? You know, Maya is telling us about the reasons that she's deciding to return to campus. How are you accommodating all of the different needs and concerns of so many constituencies that rely on Middlebury College?
Great question, Jane, and I think the complexity is certainly there. I just want to begin by noting that we've got experience to build on here. In particular, we had the rapid transition to remote learning in the spring, which was really kind of emergency remote learning. But right now, we're in the process of educating online around 1,300 students in our summer language schools and Breadloaf School of English. So we're going to be learning some lessons there, too.
Are they still supposed to follow the language pledge? That seems exceedingly difficult this year.
I suspect that the language pledge is somewhat modified for those students this summer. It's a different kind of environment. But there's a lot of extracurricular activity happening in an attempt to replicate what happens during the summer. What we're trying to do is we're trying to provide faculty with the freedom to decide how best to deliver their classes, whether it's remotely, in person, or hybrid. We do think that's an important part of academic freedom. What's interesting here, too, is that when we first surveyed faculty, around 37% said they wanted to teach online. And now as we're building out the schedule, it's looking to be more closer to half. And I think an important point to mention here is that since we've got more time to prepare for online education, it's not going to be like the emergency remote education that we did in the spring. There's a lot. We have a dedicated and committed faculty, and we also have fantastic staff in our digital learning operations that have, I think, really sort of given faculty the confidence that they can be offering really high-quality work online. So I just want to make that point that online does not mean inferior.
So what about you, Professor Essig? How are you thinking about the fall semester and your own role in teaching and then, you know, the wider role of all of the faculty and staff in figuring out how to make this work?
For me personally, I'm going to teach online, although obviously if the visa decision of the Trump administration isn't changed, I would teach some version of an in-person class for international students who need it.
And just to recap, I think many people have heard about this, but the decision has been that foreign students who are in the U.S. on student visas, if they're taking all online classes, will not be allowed to remain in the country. And so many professors, and we interviewed one on Morning Edition, Professor Isham, the other day, are saying, like you, they will teach in person so that international students are able to remain in the country.
Right. Let me be clear. I'm not planning on teaching in person, though, because I just don't think it can possibly be safe under current conditions, and especially now that the World Health Organization has talked about aerosols and how contagion happens in enclosed spaces. I just don't think that's a safe move for me or for most people, including the students. And I personally think pedagogically I'll do a better job online, exactly what Jeff was saying right now, that I can make a very interactive and participant-based class online that would be much more difficult in person if everyone's socially spaced out, wearing masks, they can't break up into discussion groups. So I'm planning on teaching online because I think it's both better from a public safety point of view, but also pedagogically going to be much better.
How do you feel about how all of these decisions have been come to and the input that various constituencies have been able to have from students and families to staff members who can't work remotely to faculty members like you who have different choices to make, but no less difficult?
Yeah, our biggest concern as the AUP is we represent a lot of people who don't have the choice or the luxury of teaching online. They can't do their work online. So I've heard from a staff member who has an underlying condition but can't perform their work online. So that person has to make a decision. Do they put their life at risk or do they potentially risk losing their job since they can't be accommodated? Those are the things that keep me up at night. It keeps me up at night to think about untenured faculty maybe feeling pressured to teach in person, even if they're not 100% comfortable with it. But we are very glad that the administration allowed professors to make that decision themselves. We're just concerned about people who can't make that decision.
Provost Kaysen, how about that? What do you advise those people?
Well, in terms of the faculty, there clearly is there's that choice, as Lori just mentioned. With staff, what we're doing is we're encouraging continued remote work for our staff if they can do that. And for those staff that have to be on campus, we're doing everything we can to provide them with the appropriate equipment and advice. Our human resources folks are working on a wide variety of options for staff. But I think I want to emphasize that what we are going to be focusing on as health and safety is really a very high priority for us going forward. And there's going to be a lot of changes that will have to happen.
Professor Essig mentioned what keeps her up awake at night. What keeps you up, Provost Kaysen?
I suppose one of the things that really worries us is if there is a significant increase in the virus in the fall and that we have to once again switch to remote. One of the things that we're doing, of course, this summer is to, in effect, prepare faculty to be able to teach online if they need to. So in other words, if we have to pivot again, we want everyone to be ready for that and to be able to do it in a higher quality way. But there's so much uncertainty out there. And I think the notion that we're going to have to be flexible and adaptable this coming fall and perhaps beyond is just going to be the watchword.
Maya, I understand you're an athlete, right? You play on the water polo team?
Yes.
So I know that fall sports, NESCAC has canceled fall sports for this year. But what about winter? What are you concerned about?
Yeah, water polo is actually a club sport at Middlebury. But I think for me personally, I've kind of braced myself and also accepted the fact that my freshman year season, since my sophomore year season kind of got stopped midseason, that my school freshman year season may have been the first and last season I'll have playing water polo for Middlebury. And that's kind of just something I've accepted. I think that with the evolving conditions, the canceling of fall sports and the NESCAC athletic division was a really, really smart decision. And I think finding as many ways as possible to minimize the spread, but maximize the ability for students to have some sense of structure when it comes to higher education is really, really important. And I think that's a trade-off that we should be willing to make.
So we heard earlier in the program, you know, from UVM, and we're hearing from Professor Essig as well, that, you know, there's some concern that some faculty members have at these schools and others that most students shouldn't be returning to campus, and that only those who feel like they need to, either because of the course of study or because perhaps of unsafe conditions at home, or as you mentioned, you know, the ability to study in a time zone that is pretty close to the one that you live in seems like a priority. You know, if you're thinking about the concerns for, you know, having a lot of people on campus and each campus trying to de-densify its campus and especially its housing, how did that factor into the decisions that you made, Maya?
I would say that that's something that I still think about every day. I've definitely committed to returning this fall. I'm also a part of residential life, so I will actually be one of the RAs who will be in the dorms with students day to day. And that's something that I've thought about every day. That's something that's definitely affected my day-to-day thinking about if I want to return and will my health be prioritized. But I think the idea of limiting the amount of students hypothetically or limiting campus to the students who need campus in order to learn, I think I would totally support that idea. And I think that at the end of the day, though, I think there are a lot of students who do intend to return to campus this fall are taking into consideration, you know, what is really at stake for a lot of people in their student body. I think the more and more peers and friends that I've talked to who in the end of the summer were really thinking like, you know what, I think returning in the fall, it'll be so nice, kind of a return to normalcy. I think they're really starting to realize what's at stake for themselves health-wise, but also at stake for their peers that really need the college campus to continue and finish their education.
And you think people are making choices in some part based on that, what they think their peers might need, not just what they'd like?
Definitely yes and no. I think, of course, some people are going back for, you know, their own reasons of wanting to see their friends and wanting to just be back on campus and to, you know, get out of their parents' houses. But I think more and more students are starting to realize that this is not a one-time semester situation. And more Middlebury students have been speaking out about, you know, what a return to campus means for them. And I think more students in the student body are starting to realize that by going back, it won't just be about them. It will be about the rest of the Middlebury community. And I think more and more students who intend to go back are really starting to process what that means.
Hmm. Lori Essig, we heard earlier in the program at UVM that the University of Vermont has made some significant pay cuts that affect something like 2,000 faculty and staff members, and they're graduated. So people who make more money have a higher percentage pay cut than those who make less. And I think those earning under $45,000, I think it is, have no pay cut at all. At Middlebury, my understanding is that the budget is expected to be formalized with no pay cuts, full pay for all staff through June of next year and no benefit cuts, although there will be a hiring freeze. But I understand that you would like to see the school draw down more on its $1 billion plus endowment.
Yeah, I think the AAUP has already convinced Middlebury that drawing more on the endowment is a good idea. The initial draw was presented at 5.8%, which is actually lower than an average in the past 10 years. The Middlebury AUP was able to show that taking up to an 8% draw on the endowment would have almost no effect at all in the long term. And so the current draw is at 7.8%. We think that's a real victory. It's allowing us to stay at our previous salary levels. I want to make clear that that's already a salary cut, right? It doesn't take into account the raises that people didn't get that they would have gotten, and it doesn't take into account the fact that cost of living has gone up slightly because of increased food prices. So I think we've already had a victory in terms of convincing the people who make those decisions that it would be a good idea to draw a little bit more. I think the problem is the way the budget is, or the way I understand the budget is, there are triggers in there that would trigger up to a 15% cut in compensation for any Middlebury employee who receives the retirement benefits, for instance, or would do a staged cut on salary. And those triggers are if we have to send the students home, or if there's some incredibly huge big cost, or if we miscalculated how much it will cost to do the testing, or, if we end up going over those triggers, then there will be compensation costs, which is really, I think, too bad, given that we have this endowment. And we don't think that the purpose of the endowment is to hoard it, but rather to spend it to take care of this once-in-a-lifetime pandemic.
Well, I know asking you to respond in 1 minute is unfair, Provost Kaysen, but in the minute we have left, what do you think about Professor Essig's concerns there?
I would say that we had a very inclusive budget-making process, and Lori is correct that there was a lot of debate and discussion about these things. We ended up not doing what many of our peers are doing in terms of cutting salaries or benefits. And that, I think, speaks to the very inclusive nature of the budgeting process. We're going to be cutting expenses dramatically this coming year. That's where the community landed, and that's where we're focusing. That said, if there is a significant shortfall in revenue, we're going to have to consider cuts in salaries and benefits. We'll know in the fall what our situation is. And our board did approve a budget with a deficit for this year that will be covered by a delay in capital expenditures as well as the increased draw on the endowment.
Well, as both of you have pointed out, so much of this depends on what happens in the fall, what happens with this virus. As we've been hearing from Dr. Fauci so many times, the virus is really in control here of what happens, although I suppose our actions are in some ways in control of what happens with the virus. But I appreciate the three of you talking with me today as you all try to figure out what the plans are going to be for the fall. Jeff Kaysen is Provost and Executive Vice President of Middlebury College. Maya G is a rising junior from Waikoloa, Hawaii, and Lori Essig is a professor and director of gender studies and president of the 190-member Middlebury AAUP, the college's chapter of the American Association of University Professors. Thanks very much to all three of you. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Jane.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Today we're looking at how Vermont colleges and universities are dealing with the stresses of trying to reopen campuses and accommodate the needs of faculty, staff, and students as the fall semester approaches. In this bit of the show, we wanted to get quick updates from a few other Vermont schools after hearing from UVM and Middlebury. Tom McHenry is president and dean of Vermont Law School, which is shifting its roughly 450 Juris Doctor law students to virtual classrooms this fall. President Henry McHenry, nice to talk with you. Thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure, Jane. Thank you.
Was it a challenge to decide to move everything into remote or virtual classrooms?
It was a great challenge, and we spent a lot of time thinking about it. Originally, we wanted to be hybrid, or what is now called hybrid flex, which would be that we would have some classes in person, some classes virtually. And then we found out that the classes that would be in person, some students wanted to have a camera in the classroom. So we call that was the flex part. And we ultimately decided that that was kind of a bronze level of teaching. If gold is an in-person class and all virtual is silver, we weren't happy with the hybrid flex model in terms of the quality of the educational experience. And we thought the best and most consistent experience could be offered virtually.
And what are the students saying so far? I mean, it sounds like you're not facing withdrawal of students because of this.
We are not. In fact, we've had some interest from students from other parts of the country and schools that are in person only, where they might want to have the choice of taking things virtually. It's too early to know, as is true for so much of this. Feedback, well, we went virtual for the last third of our spring semester, and much, I think, to both the students and faculty surprise, the experience was generally a positive one. So we're hoping we can recreate that, although we will be recreating that, you know, from scratch, in that the classes will start virtually. But our summer program, we have about 50 classes taught this summer in our summer environmental program and restorative justice program, and some early start first-year students. Feedback's been pretty good so far.
And you are opening some parts of campus. You're going to allow library pickups and drop-offs and stuff like that.
We're doing that now, allowing pickup and drop off, and so we have some essential employees, and the campuses never looked as, rooms have never looked as clean and sparkling because we're doing a deep clean. But we are certainly going to try to see if we can't provide some study spaces in the library and classrooms for students and have some limited number of student events subject to protocols. But as I'm sure you know, and all the listeners know, those protocols are evolving as we learn more about the virus.
How is this affecting the school financially, though? VLS has had some bumps in the road, to put it mildly, in terms of financial stability, and something like this is affecting every school financially. What's the impact on yours?
Well, absolutely. Fortunately, so far, the financial impacts have not been gigantic. We have not lost a lot of students, and we're generally a tuition-driven law school, so that's a positive, and we were able to get some CARES Act payroll protection funding. We are hoping not planning to make any layoffs at this point. We're not increasing anybody's salaries or doing cost of living increases. We haven't done those for a while. So our fingers are crossed, but we face larger issues in the legal academy generally, with declining enrollments in law schools and increased discount rates that we're doing our best to manage.
And in terms of the financial impact on the community, with maybe fewer people living near campus and certainly fewer people eating out, et cetera?
Absolutely. And we are a huge economic driver in the small town of South Royalton, as you can imagine. We're the only law school in the United States without a stoplight. We just have a couple of stop signs downtown. Interestingly, a large number of our students, we don't quite know how many, but as many as half of our students are still planning to come to South Royalton, live in their apartments, eat, you know, shop at the co-op, eat in any local restaurants to the degree they can. So we're hoping that will at least limit the economic impact. But a number of our students will be staying home and not coming to South Royalton, and that will be unfortunate.
That's Tom McHenry, president and dean of Vermont Law School, which, as we mentioned, is shifting its about 450 Juris Doctor Law students to virtual classrooms this fall. President McHenry, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're very welcome, Jay.
All right, let's get the perspective of one more school in here before we end, and this time from Goddard College, which has the advantage of having already been a low residency school before the pandemic. So maybe Goddard has some advice for other schools and students for how to do this off-campus learning thing well. Joining us now is Goddard President Bernard Bull. Welcome to the show, President Bull.
Thanks for having me.
So, as I said, you already had a low residency model. Has that made figuring out what to do in this fall semester a little bit easier for Goddard?
It has and it hasn't. There are two sides to it. One is we don't depend financially upon room and board, for example, for a full semester as a traditional residential campus would. So it doesn't impact our financial model very much. But given that we're low residency, and for the listeners who don't know what that means, our students come for these intensive time periods, like 10 days intensively on campus, really rich, robust learning and interaction and relationship building. And then they design personal learning plans that they continue remotely through the rest of the semester. So for us, the adjustment was, and we had to make an adjustment last semester for our last residency, just one program. What we did was we essentially took that 10-day experience and turned it into almost like a virtual conference or a virtual residency, and the rest of our semester continued as normal. The challenge for us, though, is that that time in person, that's really important to relationship building, people getting to know one another, student-student relationships, student-faculty relationships, and so for us, the real challenge is how do you maintain and strengthen that without that physical presence?
And what are you thinking? How will you do that?
Well, one of the things that was interesting for the last residency, we by the way, for our fall semester started in July already because each program has its different starts. So we're already in our second residency for the fall semester. But going back to the spring semester with our last program, one of the things that I thought was fascinating was that we used live video conferencing quite a bit for many of the activities. Of course, many people are aware, those who are working right now from home are aware of Zoom exhaustion, this kind of, you know, sitting in front of a screen for an extended period of time. But I was really delighted to see how people embrace this as an experiment and an opportunity to engage in interactions other than just sort of content-based conversation. So, for example, I understood that there was a, for the residency in the spring, they had a dance party, a virtual dance party. And one thing that typically can't happen is family members couldn't be involved when they're on campus. But in this case, family members were able to step in front of the screen and they had this interesting dance party. There were poetry readings and other kinds of community-like experiences that weren't more sort of formal, structured classroom-like activities.
So maybe some silver lining there, although it does sound like also some pretty significant challenges.
Yeah, certainly. I'm sure that the vast majority of people would very much prefer to be here on campus in that really intimate residency experience, although we have found because we made the decision to go virtual for the fall very early, we had to because of our early start. We made the decision back in April. We have actually found that it helped with our enrollment quite a bit. And there are some students who have already indicated that they're not sure that they would want to come back in person in the spring yet either.
Hmm. Well, we'll have to find out that decision, I guess, later on. Bernard Bull is president of Goddard College. Thank you very much for taking the time to share with us what's happening at your college. I appreciate it.
Thanks.